Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mdiwa Gavaza, and for today, because it is a Friday, as we do at the end of each week, we look back at the week in economics. And for this week, there have been a number of different issues and stories making the rounds, but no doubt the issue that's on every economist's mind at the moment is the GDP figures that came out from Stats SA earlier in the week, just confirming how bad COVID-19 and the lockdown affected South Africa in the second quarter of 2020. To help us to unpack what this means, maybe some of the standouts of this results release, we are joined on the line by Nicola Weimer, who is the chief economist at Nedbank Group. Nicola, greetings to you. What do you make of this week's announcement from Stats SA?
Well, I think it was worse than everyone expected. We had personally forecast a contraction of 47.5% quarter on quarter, seasonally adjusted and annualized. And as you know, it was 51. But everybody knew it was going to be bad. It was just a question of how bad. And given that there's a huge margin of error here, it's not like you can use a model to try and figure out what the impact would have been. I think that the market's forecast was fairly reflective of what ultimately happened. And, you know, it suggested that it was a horrific quarter. But like I said, that was well known and understood. The only surprise was that it was a little bit worse than most people expected.
Now, Nicola, some of the numbers that have been floated around, because the number that did come out of Stats SA is that the economy did contract by 51%, on an annualized basis. But at the same time, we have the contraction, also being quoted at 16%. You know, most people that do listen, I'm sure, do understand the difference. But for those that don't, could you just indulge us by just explaining the difference between that 16% and that 51%?
Okay, so 16% is by how much the economy shrunk in the second quarter if you compare it to the second quarter of last year, right? 51% is how much the economy shrunk in the second quarter if you compare it to the first quarter of this year, and you annualize the rate. In other words, you assume the rate by which it shrunk over that one quarter is maintained for the next four quarters. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that that certainly makes perfect sense.
But I think the number people should focus on is, where are we in the first half of the year? How much smaller is this economy in the first half of the year compared to exactly the same half last year? And that is 8.7%. So that suggests you will very rarely find that you'll be way off at the end of the year from that sort of number. We know that in GDP, the first, second, and third quarters, they are material in impacting what your decline over the year will be. The final quarter, it's a little bit too late to make a big difference to 2020's growth rate, but of course it has a material impact on 2021 because it determines the base from which you start. So this third quarter, which is almost over now, and by how much the economy actually grew over that quarter will determine whether we end the year at a minus 10, a minus 9, a minus 8.7 where we are at the moment, or maybe a little bit better at a minus 8. But we're going to be somewhere between 8% and 10% down. This much we know, just based on what has happened in the first half of the year.
I definitely understand, the reasoning behind, that determination about comparing the first half and then having it as a lead indicator for what the annual rate will be at the end of the year. But if you'll indulge me for a moment, would you not say that, this year's situation is made a bit different by the fact that your third and fourth quarters, especially the third quarter, are made a little bit more significant because your third quarter, you're sort of trying to plow back the losses of the second quarter and, trying to at least get people, because it feels as if the fight is to get to March levels or pre-COVID levels. So does that not make the third quarter a bit more important, especially just considering the opening up and, people going back to work and that March to reduce what that overall contraction will be?
Yeah, the third quarter still matters. So that's what I'm saying. For the year as a whole, it's quarter one, two, and three that has an important bearing. Your final quarter is more important for where we start next year. But in terms of determining this year's growth rate, that third quarter matters tremendously. So we contracted at an annualized rate of 51%. So let's say we get a rebound of 28%. Then that's bad. You understand what I'm saying? It may sound fantastic, but that's actually bad. If the rebound in the third quarter is over 30%, then that's kind of reasonable. Then maybe we have a contraction closer to 8%. But that's the kind of ranges you're talking about. But to get way below 8% with the first half of the year already done, statistically, it's just not going to be very easy. If for the third quarter to sort of wipe out what happened in the second quarter, you would need the economy literally to rebound at an annualized rate of over 51% in the third quarter. Then it's going to make a difference. But that seems highly unlikely. That's not what the numbers are suggesting. Like I said, we're almost done with this quarter. So there is a recovery occurring without a doubt. But if you look at June and July's numbers, the manufacturing, that recovery has been quite a bit more persuasive. But they're still down minus 10% from where they were at the same time last year. That is even when you count in stronger than expected improvement in manufacturing production in July. As for mining, the recovery there has not been quite as convincing. It's been better in July than in June. But again, you're still down over 10% year on year. So you understand what I'm saying? That minus 8.7% is starting to look pretty reliable at this point for more or less the range which you're going to be in.
I guess with that in mind, then, from the different sectors whose results we got this week, it was seen, I think most people did expect that agriculture would have seen, the growth that it did. But were there any surprises in the data set for you, or was it sort of as expected all around?
One of the big surprises for me, it wasn't as expected all around. The biggest surprise for me, I have to say, anticipated completely, because you do get monthly numbers, so you can actually calculate what happens in most of the sectors. You can calculate what happens in mining and manufacturing. So that was all as expected. Electricity production was all as expected. Even trade and accommodation, there's enough monthly statistics to figure out with a fair degree of certainty what was going to happen. So I suppose the big surprise were the sectors that you don't have regular monthly numbers on. And for me, there, the big one was finance, real estate, and business services, which contracted by 28% quarter-on-quarter annualized rate, that is. And general government, which declined modestly by 0.6%, but given that you would have assumed there was quite an acceleration in spending on healthcare, and there was also an acceleration in spending on you know, just emergency support to those very severely affected by COVID-19 and by the lockdown. The fact that it's still contracted suggests perhaps that within government they are indeed tightening the screws on spending. And then personal services, which includes a big portion of the health sector, that was quite a surprise. But it shows you how big the private sector is within that particular broader sector, because you had a contraction of 32%. So even though you would have imagined that healthcare as a whole would have had increased activity quite significantly over the second quarter, in fact, the overall sector declined. So that shows you just how much, how big a proportion of that sector is made up by private healthcare. And given that consultations and elective surgery and things like that were not allowed, the impact of that ultimately on the sector's performance was actually quite dramatic.
And against that backdrop, what do these figures then mean? How do they bode for South Africa's international perception, especially where ratings agencies are concerned? Because I think earlier in the week, Moody's did give, you know, some thoughts about how weakness in the economy could affect the country going forward. So what does that mean? I mean, at the beginning of the lockdown, I remember there was some minor debate. We all expected that Moody's would finally downgrade South Africa, but there had been some debate at the time that, you know, perhaps they could stave off, you know, downgrading the country because of the effects of COVID. But it did happen. And now, you know, they are already talking about how these figures will in turn affect the economy. So in your view, how are you seeing that?
I think that from any kind of angle that you view South Africa, and for no matter how long you look at the picture, the one trend that has been very clearly established in South Africa is that over the past decade, this economy's growth rate has dissipated, it has declined, it has slowed. We are stuck in the longest economic downswing in recorded history. This might be the worst recession or depression, if you like, we've experienced since the Great Depression itself, but there are specifics behind that. The whole idea that you impose such an incredibly strict lockdown and you basically just switched off the economy. It was to be expected that that effect would be incredibly dramatic. So no one should be surprised by that. But what really matters is the long journey to get to where we are now. And it was a bad journey. Our economic performance has been shocking over this period. Unemployment has escalated throughout. Inequalities have continued to grow. And all of that is reflected in government's fiscal position. And so when Moody's gives a sovereign risk rating, they are really giving a rating of government's performance and managing the country's finances. And they are giving an indication to international investors as to whether there is any risk that South Africa could default on both its principal and its interest. And so that is essentially their duty, whether it be Moody's, whether it be S&P, whether it be Fitch. And the reality is that COVID-19 has made a bad situation even worse. And these numbers have an enormous bearing on a government's fiscal position. They have not managed the country's finances well. If they did, we would not be sitting with budget deficits in February already of over 6% of GDP. Now we're talking of around 13% of GDP, bearing in mind that already in the first half of this year, the economy has performed worse than National Treasury estimated it would in its supplementary budget, which is what all their estimates are based on. So that means that the revenue they're going to get in is going to be probably far less than they had anticipated and budgeted for. And the bottom line of that means that they're probably going to run a much bigger budget deficit. Now, I think they might be forgiven for that, given that they have got emergency funding from the IMF at this point, and it will help them carry through. But what it all means, this really shocking economic performance is if you can't grow your path out of this trouble, it means you have to somehow make cuts to government spending. And you have to make these cuts in an environment in which your economy is shrinking faster than you can cut, which means that your deficit continuously continues to rise, your debt burden continues to climb, and it just brings us every single day a little bit closer to a sovereign risk crisis, which is the last thing we need. So it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on government to come up with a workable plan in October. And I think the key here will have to be on how do you restore confidence in the private sector and how do you get the private sector to drive economic growth. Because I think the one thing we now absolutely have to accept is that government cannot drive growth when they're already sitting with budget deficits of over 10% of GDP.
So with that in mind, we've seen, I think, two budget speeches from, the finance minister at the start of the year, and then one, sort of in response to what was going on with COVID-19. So going forward, given what you've just said, what do you think Minister Mboweni's focus is going to be? Because we can't approach, whatever upcoming budgets in the same way as before, and whatever reasoning was given in the past surely can't stand at this time.
Well, I think I have no idea what his approach is going to be. I think he's made his position and that of National Treasury clear, has he not? He has said that government needs to only spend in line with, to contain its spending in line with the size of the economy. So if the economy is shrinking, that obviously means that government also has to shrink at this point its expenditure. He's placed the emphasis on rooting out corruption, getting rid of wasteful spending, and for that purpose, or as a part of that whole sort of austerity drive, they have now said they will introduce zero budgeting. And then, of course, he's placed the emphasis on the fact that ideally government does not want to cut back on infrastructure spending, although they probably have to. They also want to bring recurrent expenditure down in the future to a more sustainable level because it is at a completely unsustainable level. So their focus is, of course, on the public sector wage bill. And there's a great amount of cynicism as to whether he will, in fact, be able to cut the public sector wage bill, but that is what they budgeted for in the supplementary budget. So he will have to show that they can deliver on that. So that, I think, he's made clear that's the path he is choosing. And then he has made a whole bunch of recommendations in the supplementary budget and in previous budgets about how National Treasury, based on that economic policy document that they brought out, believe you can rejuvenate the South African economy. And it all really comes down to simplifying red tape to get rid of destructive legislation, of which there is quite a lot in the case of South Africa, to solve the energy crisis, to really award greater spectrum, to pick the low-hanging fruit, and to reduce the cost of production across a broad range of industries. And there a big focus, of course, have been to get the private sector more actively involved in delivering infrastructure. And another big focus, of course, have been to resolve what appears to be just impossible problems within state-owned enterprises. So that, I think, is what he's going to probably again present as the route out, the solution. But I think in and of itself, it is not going to give anybody any comfort. It is most definitely not going to impress rating agencies. The only thing that will impress rating agencies is if firm decisions are made. Like, for example, we are selling SAA to Ethiopian Airlines, or we are deregulating the energy market. Yes, you've got to get a spectrum. You have to get a license, but you can apply for it online and you'll receive it in 48 hours, not like a six-month process. The tender process for spectrum will occur next week on this and this date. I think it's come to that where they've made the same promises repeatedly that it's now gotten to that level where they will have to actually show and produce action for anyone to believe them.
And as part of that, one of the things that people have made a lot of promises on and about is energy production, specifically with Eskom, you know, the most indebted of the state-owned enterprises, and probably a big part in how the country would be able to actually recover in the near to medium term. But I wanted to get a sense from you, because you said something interesting earlier on when you're talking about the things that had been expected as part of the sectors and some of the declines that had been modeled and expected. And you said energy production so far, you know, has sort of gone, you know, sort of as expected. So does that then mean that generally in the economic fraternity, Eskom's sort of inability to cope with the demand as, you know, more activity picks up, had that sort of been factored in the way that people are thinking about where economic production is going to go for the rest of the year?
Absolutely. Well, we have. So we have basically scaled down our GDP forecast for the next 3 to 5 years based on structural imbalances and impediments, of which the biggest one is, in fact, Eskom and the lack of reliable and cost-effective energy. So, yes, we have definitely worked that into our forecast.
Yeah, I think I wasn't expecting you to say 3 to 5 3 to 5 years, so that actually does sound quite dire.
Yes, now listen, I mean, we have to be realistic. If Eskom is struggling to cope in a situation where an economy shrinks, let's use the 16% year on year in the second quarter, where there's virtually no demand for energy, then it gives you a situation of how, an indication of how bad the situation is. Now, Eskom themselves had said that there is an increased risk of load shedding up until November next year. That's their own words, straight from the CEO of Eskom. So the big reason they are given, have provided for that, is not what has happened recently, where some power stations have been mismanaged again and there were unexpected outages. But the reason there's an increased risk until November next year is apparently because they're going to undertake what is called reliability maintenance. So apparently this is where you switch off big parts of your generating capacity and you fix it properly. So that apparently is what's going to happen. But honestly, that's their word. We don't really know what's happening there and why we find ourselves in this situation over and over and over again. It's a little bit like Groundhog Day. So unfortunately, I think it's going to be very significant drag on growth until the end of next year. And then hopefully it will start to lessen, but it will still be there. It will still be an issue.
Nicola, as we come to the end of this discussion, what do you make of, the recovery or prospects thereof in other countries in the region? You know, as Nedbank, you guys do have operations, you know, outside of South Africa. So what do you make of activity in some of your representative countries?
I think in all African countries, it has to be said that we have seen the effects of lockdown, either because they have directly themselves imposed some form of lockdown. Of course, not nearly as strict as South Africa's, but nonetheless, they've closed their borders, they introduced social distancing, and they basically prohibited gatherings of certain sizes. And so there was some form of lockdown or the other in every single African country. And if they did have a fairly easy form of lockdown, like some countries did, they were still exposed to the effects of COVID-19 through the export markets, because for many African countries, they are either oil or commodity exporters. That group of individuals were very badly, or that group of countries were very badly affected, of course, by the lockdowns and especially China and Asia, and then also later on the lockdown in Europe. And as a result, export demand dropped very sharply. We also saw that oil prices declined very sharply. So it's been a big hit to Angola, Nigeria, and all of your oil-producing and exporting African countries. And generally speaking, all commodity producers have been hurt through the process. Then, as you know, in Kenya, they've also had a locust infestation, which have destroyed crops in a very, very dramatic and serious manner, and that affected their performance. They are big exporters in the flour market, so the collapse in global activity also affected them from that side. But generally speaking, certainly East Africa has proved to be quite resilient. We have seen continued strong performances coming out of Ethiopia, coming out of Kenya, coming out of Rwanda, Uganda. So there are countries that have been fairly resilient and that has weathered storm particularly well. But everyone has been affected. And that's the thing with COVID-19. It is a global problem. It is both a global health problem and it is also a global economic problem.
COVID-19 is both a global health problem and a global economic problem. That's us with Nicola Weimer, who is the chief economist at Nedbank Group, giving us some insights into what is easily the biggest economic news of the week, and that was the 51% contraction in the economy in the second quarter of 2020. At the beginning, she was just explaining to us the differences between the 16% and the 51%, that's measuring one quarter versus the other, this quarter versus the same quarter last year, and also just talking about the fact that for the most part this was in line with the expectations. We all knew that things were going to be bad, but it was just a matter of how bad things are going to be. Ending off the discussion, just talking about the effect of Eskom. We keep hearing about it, but she's saying that in their model, they've actually have it as a bigger risk now, and have had to scale down some of the expectations for the next 3 to 5 years because of some of the structural issues at the power utility. Also, just talking about what's going on in other African countries that have been all affected by COVID-19, especially as most African countries are commodity exporters. But she's saying that in regions like East Africa, there has been resilience, particularly in countries like Kenya and Ethiopia, Rwanda, and the like. So that's been it. A very good discussion. Thank you so much to Nicola for being with us.
This is Mudiwa's Take.
A 51% contraction in the second quarter of 2020 is much worse than a lot of people had anticipated. And even the 16% is much worse, because a lot of people had been making it sit around 40-45%. That's what a lot of the general consensus had been. But it just shows the actual reality. We keep talking about the fact that we anticipated, we thought, we theorized, conceptualized how bad the quarter was actually going to come out and look like. But as Nicola is saying, it was actually slightly worse than people had anticipated. It wasn't about how bad or good, it was about how bad and by how much, right? But more than anything else, going forward, it means that the third quarter numbers are going to have to be very important. But I'm also interested, I don't have the years of experience, that Nicola does. And I do take what she was saying, very seriously about the fact that the first, second and third quarter are good indications of what the overall numbers will be. But for this year, I'm still just keen to see what that fourth quarter will be. And that's in light of the previous conversation that we had in our last episode with the Tourism Business Council of South Africa, because If we're able to go to a level one and tourism does come back as a large GDP contributor, not only that, but then, you know, the rest of the industries we know would have recovered and us just having a quarter that is normal. I feel like something can be said about that. It might not have as much of an impact as Nicola was saying and perhaps provide that basis for where 2021 starts, but I really think it will be important for us to enter that fourth quarter at a level one, just to give the economy a fighting chance, particularly as we go forward into 2021. A lot of people have pushed back their plans to next year. So where do we begin will be determined by what these last 3 to 4 months of the year are going to be set on. That's the first thing. The second thing to also just think about is the fact that, yes, there's been a recovery in starting slightly in level four, one or two things open, but more level three and into level two, there's been that recovery, but still it's been a recovery that has had restrictions. So what actually happens when, okay, it's done now, we've just opened everything up, things economically at least back to normal? Yes, there's the human behavior, which is likely to still remain, you know, a bit subdued, because people's behavior has likely changed. COVID-19 is still a reality until we get a vaccine. So some of you might open everything up, but the activity might not go back to how people were acting, you know, pre the lockdown. So that's going to be something to definitely watch. But allowing the last quarter to at least happen unrestricted, I think that will be important for the economy going forward. So that's been it in terms of this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Life, that is under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter, where #BDSpotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller, together with Didi Mashamaite. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.